Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Aaron Maté, Jen Yutes, Anuradha Bhagwati, Megan Whitney, Mike DiFilippo, Nick Marsilio, and Miguel Noguera are our engineers. Thanks also to Angela Alston, Uri Galette, Hugh Grand, John Randolph, Kieran Krug-Meadows, Jerome Bourgeois, and Samantha Chambly. Again, our website is democracynow.org. You can sign up there for our daily headlines and for our transcripts as well. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
And you're listening to radio station WUSB, Stony Brook, New York. It's 6 o'clock. Time for Off the Wall. And good evening to everybody. Sorry again for the delay. I was just reading the news. Well, the headline that everyone is going to be talking about for the next couple of days, I guess, is, oh boy, did you see what the stock market did? It fell down. It fell down a lot. What was it, 415 points? Is that what it went down today? That's what it closed at? At one point it was 500. I got to say, you know, who cares? I mean, I love the chaos. I love people panicking and running around like nuts. and saying, oh my God, what are we going to do about our portfolio? But, you know, in the end, it doesn't really affect us. When it all comes down to it, the rich are going to stay rich, the poor are going to stay poorer, and a whole lot of other people are just not going to feel anything whatsoever. But I found it interesting. I was just looking at this story. They're saying now that the speed of today's big drop was partially a result of a computer glitch. So somehow a computer is responsible for the Dow plummeting. I don't know if that's a tactic to get it not to plummet tomorrow. Not knowing anything about stocks, how they work, not caring, all I can say is what's going to happen is you might see a little bit of a drop tomorrow, but guaranteed the day after that it's going to start going up again, and that's the way it works. I don't know the first thing about these numbers. I mean, people try to explain this to me over and over again. It never takes, you know, because I guess I just have no interest in it in the end. But basically, the Dow Jones Industrial Average went down 416.02 points to 12,216.24. And, you know, there are people out there who know the difference between 0.24 and 0.23, and it matters to them. It really does somehow. And to me, you know, it's more meaningless than sports. It really is. Even though there are people who, this is what they do. This is what they do all the time. Anyway, it was the biggest one-day point loss since the day the stock market reopened after September 11th. Yeah, on that day, the Dow lost 684.81 points. So that sort of puts it into perspective, doesn't it? It lost about 3.3%, in case you keep track of that kind of a thing. Now, the broader S&P 500 was down 50.33 to 1,399.04. The NASDAQ, I could be speaking Greek, down 96.66 to 2,407.86. The Russell 2000, I've never heard of this one before, the Russell 2000, down 31.03 to 792.66. And, you know, this is what everybody's just going to be talking about this for the next few days. And I guarantee you, go to all the news channels. They're, in addition to the annoying news tickers they have now as a result of the September 11th panic, now they're going to have little stock tickers again. They had those for a while after the crash and after September 11th. They had stock market tickers. Now they're going to have those again so we can keep an eye on these meaningless numbers and see just what's going on, even though nobody really knows. Unbelievable. So, yeah, that's the news that you're going to be hearing about from now until whenever the next crisis hits. I just thought it was amusing, and that's all the time we're going to spend on that. Real news of the day. What was the real news? Well, I don't know about today, but the real news of yesterday was that I got sick. I was really sick for the first time in ages. And when I say sick, I mean not you know, walking around with sniffles or anything like that. I mean the kind of sickness that keeps you from sleeping at night, you know, the kind of sickness that drives you out of bed and makes things very unpleasant. I don't want to get too graphic. I don't think I'm allowed to, for one thing. But let's just say that something disagreed with me. Something disagreed violently with me. And I don't know how that kind of thing works. All I know is trying to fall asleep on Sunday night. And that's the other thing. I was on a daytime schedule. Whenever I get onto a daytime schedule, something always happens to catapult me right back into a night owl schedule. Happens every time. I was on this wonderful schedule, waking up at 10 in the morning, which I know to many people out there is really, really late. To me, that's incredibly early. Anytime I can say I woke up before noon, it's a miracle. It really is. But there are people out there who wake up at 6 o'clock in the morning earlier to go to work, to go to school. I used to be one of them. And I can't imagine. I can't imagine how you live. Because to me, I get most work done after midnight, I guess, when there are less distractions. But in any event, I was on this nice schedule. I actually went to sleep at something like 4 in the morning, which is really early for me. But something wasn't working quite right. Something wasn't sitting well. And you know that feeling you get when you just know it's this isn't going to end well. And sure enough, it was something I ate the night before, and just kept having me getting up and going to visit a particular room, which, again, I don't want to get into too many graphic details. And it was obvious that there was some kind of a purge going on, some kind of a routing of the system, you know, to clean things out, to get rid of the invaders. And apparently that wasn't enough. The human body is an amazing thing, because when it knows something doesn't belong, it does everything possible to exterminate it, to get rid of it. And basically what happened was, I just had to go through all different sorts of methods of doing that. And let me just say, it was the first time since, and I wrote down the date, the last time that I got sick to my stomach was on December 7th, 1994. That's right. I was doing brain damage back then. December 7th, 1994, that was the last time I had gotten sick to my stomach. It was quite a stretch. Now, I should put a couple of asterisks there, because there were a couple of occasions in between then and now where, in fact, due to overindulging in a particular liquid substance, I don't want to give the wrong impression that I go out on benders or anything like that, but occasionally you're having a conversation with somebody, you're in a bar, and before you know it, you've downed, three or four drinks, which to most people, or many people anyway, is not all that much. But to me, I'm kind of, a lightweight in that department. So sometimes some chemicals don't react well. There were a couple of occasions where that led to having the body basically saying, get rid of this now. And didn't really have much choice in the matter. I don't count that. I don't know if that's fair, but I don't count that as being sick to your stomach. I mean, it's sort of like, sticking your finger down your throat. Does that count? You're not really sick. You just sort of, you sort of overdid it. And I guess, technically, now that I think of it, technically, I wasn't really sick yesterday. I got food poisoning of some sort and had to get rid of all that. And the time before that, December 7th, 1994, there was also a case of something disagreeing with me. It wasn't like when I was a kid and I had, the fever and I was sick in bed for days, basically having all sorts of nasty things going on. And that's when you get sick to your stomach and you're really sick. And I think every kid goes through that, sort of a rite of passage. I can't remember the last time I was sick like that, because the time before 1994 was in the early 80s, and that was on a whale-watching boat. And that doesn't count either, because I got seasick. There was the boat tossing and turning, so that's when I got sick that time. So I honestly can't remember the last time I got sick as a result of having, say, the flu or some kind of a cold or rheumatic fever, whatever gets you sick these days. But I felt like it was history yesterday when I finally did succumb to that, and it wasn't very pleasant. But I got to say, afterwards, it's really this sense of relief you feel, because it doesn't get any worse than that. It doesn't get any worse than the feeling that you get right before you get sick to your stomach. And you always have that moment of warning. Again, the human body is amazing. It gives you that final call, okay, this is it. This is not a drill. Go to your stations immediately. And it gives you that amount of time to get there. Time to the millisecond. But once that's over, and you pick yourself up, you're trembling, you feel like you've lost 50 pounds, from that point on, things just start getting better, and you start to relax. And it's very important. It's very important in a situation like that you know that you can let everything go, that you don't have to worry about certain things, that you just have to sit back, that taking care of yourself is the most important thing, and just relax and rest and do whatever you have to do to get better. And I worry how many people don't have that, how many people feel like they have to finish this project or get this assignment done or talk to these people, and in the end, that's not what matters. So basically, I just spent the day yesterday convalescing. And the thing is, I didn't eat anything. I drank a lot of fluids, because you're supposed to replenish your fluids. And my body was telling me, hey, have a couple of pretzels. Those are good. I don't know why. That's what it asked for. I wasn't about to argue, because it had shown me what it can do if I cause it any problems whatsoever. So that's all I had in the last day, pretty much. And I'm not feeling any hunger or anything like that, so it's basically this whole reconstruction process that's going on. But in a way, I sort of feel reborn. I sort of feel like, okay, fresh start now. Let's do it right this time. So, with any luck, you won't hear another speech like this from me until gosh, 2018 or something like that, if the particular streak keeps going. But, yeah, it wasn't a very productive day as far as work goes, but at least I made it here. That's the important thing. Okay, what's going on in the world? It's always fun to look, isn't it? Iran has no brake and no reverse gear in its nuclear program. This is brilliant. I just had to read this because of the quotes that are coming out of this region now. President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad said Sunday that yes, Iran has obtained the technology to produce nuclear fuel, and Iran's move is like a train, which has no brake and no reverse gear. Now, okay, I'm not sure if he just doesn't understand trains, or if he's talking about a broken train. But I'd like to correct him on that. A train damn well better have brakes. Otherwise, how are you going to stop it? You do have to stop a train now and then. All right? And as for reverse gears, yes, you know, they do have reverse gears too. I've been on trains that move backwards for whatever reason. Sometimes they overshoot the station. Sometimes the track is closed up ahead and they have to go backwards. Sometimes you have to swap out engines and it's important to hit reverse every now and then. Every train can go backwards and forwards. In fact, look at the Long Island Railroad. Come over here. Come over here, President Ahmadinejad, and watch the Long Island Railroad go from Port Jefferson to Huntington, okay? What you'll see, you'll see two engines. You'll see one in the front and one in the back. Now, the one in the back is the one pushing from Port Jefferson to Huntington. And the one in the front, I think, that provides electric power. I don't know why they need two. I'm not going to get into that. They basically move in one direction. Now, there's no turnaround at Huntington. Huntington is where you have to switch because that's where the tracks become electric. You don't always have to switch. Sometimes you can switch at Hicksville. Sometimes you can go all the way into Jamaica. There's one train a day that goes all the way into Penn Station. Yeah, a one-seat ride from Port Jefferson to Penn Station. That's incredible. But that's all irrelevant. What happens at Huntington is that the train starts going back to Port Jefferson the other way. It doesn't turn around. So what happens then? The engine in the back, which is now in the front, is now pulling. So it's going the opposite direction. It's going in reverse, okay? Trains do go in reverse. All right. Let's just hope that you're not running the nuclear program, too, because your knowledge of trains is far from complete. And if somebody like me can tell you about trains, then you are in trouble, my friend. Big trouble. U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice clocked in on this one. They don't need a reverse gear. They need a stop button. All right, Condoleezza, you know, you don't know much about trains either. There are no stop buttons in trains. I mean, there's the emergency brake, but are you really suggesting hitting the emergency brake? That causes all kinds of problems. And you just have to reset it, and the train winds up going again. Everybody's inconvenienced. Let's just agree that the train analogy is not the right one. How about Iran has as much right to nuclear technology as any other country in the world? All right. No country should be treated as if they're some kind of stupid child that should not be given a plaything. If you start treating them that way, then they're going to start acting even worse. The time to debate the spread of nuclear technology was back when it was being developed. And now, you know, it's too late. It's too late. You can't put the genie back in the bottle. It's out there. You can't have a world where, yeah, the United States... Well, you know, we used the technology once, so I guess that gives us the right to tell everybody else how to use it and who can have it and who can't. Kind of doesn't work from the rest of the world's perspective. The sooner we realize that, the better. Okay, what else is going on here? Good news out of Canada. Canada's Supreme Court struck down a controversial anti-terror law. They did this on Friday, that allows foreign suspects to be detained indefinitely on the basis of secret evidence. It's like they're civilized. Amazing. The court ruled unanimously that the government had broken Canada's Charter of Rights and Freedoms by issuing so-called security certificates to imprison people pending deportation without giving them a chance to see the government's case. Before the state can detain people for significant periods of time, it must accord them a fair judicial process. That's according to Chief Justice Beverly McLaughlin. And she wrote on behalf of all nine judges. The secrecy required by the certificate scheme denies the named person the opportunity to know the case out, against him or her, and hence to challenge the government's case. Yes. The court suspended the ruling for a year to allow Parliament time to rewrite the relevant part of the Immigration and Refugee Protection Act, under which the certificates are issued. But it's a step, I guess, a step in the right direction. So let's take a step in the other direction now and look at this week's panic. Three CD players hidden under a cathedral's pews blared sexually explicit language in the middle of an Ash Wednesday mass, leading a bomb squad to detonate two of the devices. Yeah, what's wrong with that story? Authorities determined the music players were not dangerous and kept the third one to check it for clues. That's according to police captain Gary Johnson. The CD players, duct taped to the bottoms of the pews, were set to turn on in the middle of noon mass on Wednesday at the Roman Catholic Cathedral Basilica of St. Francis of Assisi. The recordings, made on store-bought blank discs, featured people using foul language and pornographic messages. Johnson would not elaborate because of the ongoing investigation, probably because he didn't want to say those words. Church staff members took the CD players to the basement and called police, who sent the bomb squad. I don't get this. They took the things, they were duct taped to the bottom of the pew, okay? For some reason, that wasn't enough to make them think, oh, these are bombs. Okay, I'm going to take these off and bring them to a room and then call the bomb squad because, well, maybe they're not actual CD players. Yeah. And then the bomb squad arrives. They blew up two of the players outside and kept the third one to test for fingerprints. What if the fingerprints were on the other ones and you blew those up? Morons, you just lost your case. And you know what? Even if there are fingerprints, this is what's known, what used to be known as a prank. Pranks were these events of the 20th century where people would just basically do goofy things, sometimes in bad taste. And they were meant to elicit a reaction that basically resulted in a lot of people laughing and maybe chugging a couple of beers and talking about it in the days and weeks to come. These days, anything out of order has to be terrorism and you must blow it up. Anyway, that's this week's little adventure in craziness. But there was another one, too. This is kind of interesting. A lot of people wrote in about this one. A man says he broke into an apartment with a cavalry sword because he thought he heard a woman being raped, but the sound actually was from a pornographic movie his upstairs neighbor was watching. Can't make this up. Now I feel stupid, said James Van Iveren, who has been charged in the case. This really is nothing but a mistake. According to a criminal complaint, the neighbor told police that Van Iveren pounded on the door and kicked it open without warning on February 12th, damaging the frame and lock. Where is she? He demanded, thrusting the sword at the neighbor. Where is she? The neighbor told police Van Iveren became increasingly aggressive as he repeated the question, insisting that he had heard a woman being raped. The complaint said that with the sword pointed at him, the neighbor led Van Iveren throughout the apartment, opening closet doors to prove he was alone. The neighbor later played for police the part of the DVD he believed Van Iveren heard downstairs. And Van Iveren said he heard a woman screaming for help, grabbed the sword, bounded up the stairs, kicked in the apartment door, and confronted the man who lived there. I intended to hold it behind my back and knock, but I froze, and instead what happened. Contesting his neighbor's account, he said he didn't look anywhere in the apartment except the front room, and that he never threatened the neighbor with the sword. I had the sword extended, but that was all. I guess, you know, you'd think that's being threatened with it if you have a sword extended in your direction. And the sword, by the way, is a family heirloom. And now he's facing 33 months in jail for using a dangerous weapon, criminal damage, disorderly conduct, criminal trespass. You know, in my opinion, why is this even before the authorities? What should happen here, okay? It's obvious what happened. It was a misunderstanding. Almost funny. It is funny. No, this is funny. This is humorous. Some guy's playing a porn tape. Someone else thinks it's real, thinks someone's being threatened, and does what he believes is the right thing. You know what? The two of you should work this out. You're both reasonably mature people, I think. Sit down, laugh about it, compensate each other for whatever was damaged, shake hands, go on your way. Keep the courts out of this. Nobody should be going to prison. Maybe people shouldn't be playing porn that loudly. Certainly not the violent kind, anyway. Jeez. And this was funny. This actually was on the CNN homepage for a couple hours. You heard about the case where the kid in Florida was kidnapped for an hour or so and found himself bound to a tree and was able to actually escape on his own. And this is the story, the front page story. The headline was, "Abducted Boy Frees Freed Bonds to Escape," police say. A 13-year-old boy abducted at gunpoint Friday from a school bus stop near Tampa, Florida, was driven to a remote location and left bound, but managed to free himself and seek help, authorities said. After getting free, Clay Moore walked until he found a farm worker whose cell phone he used to call his mom, Sheriff Charlie Wells said. Clay's uncle said, "It's one of the phone calls you don't want to get." I mean, I'm sure that's not what he meant. You don't want to get the phone call that says your kid is safe? Yeah. He was either misquoted or quoted out of context, or he doesn't like the kid at all, or who knows. But in any event, that was taken down about an hour after it was posted. But I thought that was pretty humorous. But yeah, I guess the motto of that story is always have safety pins on you if you think you might be kidnapped and bound to a tree. Comes in very handy. And here's the good idea of the week. The Postal Authority is coming up with an idea to have a forever stamp. And this makes a lot of sense. As someone who deals with mailing things out an awful lot, they're always changing the postal rates. And what they've done lately, since they don't even know, they know they're going to raise the rates, they don't know what they're going to raise them to, they don't even put the price on the stamp. It just says first-class postage, you don't know how much it's worth. And if you put the wrong one on, that your mail gets returned or not delivered. How are you supposed to know this is a 37-cent first-class stamp? It doesn't say it on it. Well, what they're proposing is to make a stamp that is always going to be a first-class stamp, regardless of how many times they raise the rates. The forever stamp, good for mailing a letter no matter how much rates rise. It was recommended Monday by the Independent Postal Regulatory Commission. Of course, they also want to raise rates to 41 cents. Whatever. But, for example, a 41-cent rate takes effect. Forever stamps would sell for 41 cents. If rates later climb to 45 cents or more, what do you mean if? When they climb to 45 cents or more, the price of the forever stamp would also go up at the counter or machine, but those purchased before the change would still be valid to mail a letter. So there'd be no need to buy those stupid 1-cent or 2-cent stamps that they always sell whenever this happens. So the solution, obviously, is to buy about 6 million of these stamps when they come out and save money over the decades and generations ahead. Okay, some very sad news for us here at WUSB. We've lost one of our own. This happened last week. Those of you familiar with us over the years since 1977 when we went on the air might be familiar with the voice of Jim Ross, who did the Back Porch Bluegrass program. And Jim Ross passed away last week here on Long Island. Hadn't been on the air for a couple of years, but anyone who was part of the station, certainly throughout the 70s, 80s, 90s, would have known his voice, would have known his demeanor, his style, his presence, because it was there. He was one of those people you just didn't forget. And as somebody who was new to this station way back, he was definitely one of those people that that you took note of. Guy just came in every Wednesday night and played bluegrass music. I had an adventure with him, actually, back in the 80s. Back in the 80s, I was able to get these playoff tickets for a Mets game, one of those rare occasions when the Mets actually made it to the playoffs. And Jim was had expressed a strong interest. And what I like to do, I like to go back in time and play you an excerpt from Brain Damage back in 1988, where I was telling that story about what had happened. It was the night before when Jim and I had gone to Shea Stadium to try and see a playoff game that didn't quite work out the way we wanted it to. But it was a fun story nonetheless. So back to 1988. It all started a couple of weeks ago when I learned that I was able to obtain playoff tickets. A friend of mine had somehow managed to get me a bunch of playoff tickets, and even before the final papers had been signed and the deals had been struck and envoys sent back and forth, there were already claims on these tickets. People already had rights to them before I even bought them. So I bought these tickets, but it was with the understanding that I give a few, or actually two, to another person and have two left over for myself. It's complicated, and it's still not over. But what it boiled down to was tickets for last night's game, the first one at Shea Stadium, Game 3, scheduled to start at 8 o'clock. And boy, was I into it. Was I into going to see a playoff game? I'd never been to a playoff game. I haven't been to a baseball game in maybe 10 years. And it wasn't a bad thing to do when I was a kid. You know, I remember going in the daytime, never to a playoff, though. You know, just a regular season, watching mediocre teams. But this, a playoff. Of course, it's quite a bit more expensive, too. I'd forgotten about that. But I figured, you know, it'd make me the first person on my block to actually be able to do something elite like this. So naturally, I was a bit concerned yesterday when I was driving in and I noticed raindrops on my windshield. Something that the weather people never seem to have mentioned. They would say cloudy, temperatures going down into the 40s, but they never said the word rain. And there's a reason for that. Because if you say the word rain, it's admitting that something could go wrong. And you don't want to do that. You don't want to get people thinking in a negative sort of way. You just want to sucker them all into it and then surprise them. Which is exactly what happened. By the time I got there, of course, it was raining quite hard. Actually, let me back up a little bit. I was supposed to meet somebody in New York and give them the two tickets that I had promised them. But for some reason, and maybe it's because they had advanced knowledge of what was going to happen, they never showed up. So by the time I got out to Shea Stadium, not only was I starting to get wet, but I also had two extra tickets, and I had to get rid of them. And that's something I never thought would be a problem. Having tickets to a playoff game. I figured maybe, you know, I could get rich or something. This could be a turning point in my life. This could be a savings fund for my kids in the future or something. Who knows how it could start, but it could start with that. Anyway, I met the person who did show up, who, by the way, does a radio show here, Jim Ross and the Bluegrass Show. Jim said a few things to me in the past. Never make fun of bluegrass music was one of them. Try to avoid having the famous USB water fights while he was on the air. Wednesday nights from 6:30 to 8:30. You won't hear water fights then. And the other thing he said to me was, if you ever by chance get a playoff ticket, let me know. And so I did have a playoff ticket. I did let him know, and we got together last night to see this game, and boy, were we into it. Of course, we had to dress for the weather. It was cold, and it was rather misty. Didn't want to say raining. It was misty and wettish. But before we could go in, we had to get rid of these two tickets. Because once you're in, you can't sell the tickets. A lot of people make that mistake. Can't sell the tickets when you're inside the stadium. Uh-uh. Nobody falls for that anymore. So we had to sort of walk around the stadium a little bit and get a feel for what people were selling tickets for. And let me just point out here that I didn't really want to sell these things for a lot of money. I just wanted to get rid of them. I wasn't going to sell them to this person in the city and make more money from them. I was just going to get what I paid for them. I just didn't want to lose anything, that's all. I just didn't want to lose any money on these tickets. I just wanted to give them to somebody and have them give me something back and be done with it. Well, guess what? For some reason, probably the first time in recorded history, playoff tickets were going for less than what they were sold for. Nobody could understand it, and they weren't selling either. Never in my life have I pitied scalpers, but you should have seen the expressions on their faces last night as they were walking around in the rain. These soaking wet scalpers looking pathetic, trying to get rid of their tickets. And maybe they were crying, or maybe it was just the water on their face, but... oh, I almost bought a ticket. That's how bad it was. I had 4 tickets, I almost bought another one. Guy looked so pathetic. But then I realized I was just as pathetic as they were, and me and Jim tried to sell those 2 tickets to anybody that would take them. And they weren't bad seats either. They were in the loge, for God's sake. Weren't up in the bleachers or the high altitude somewhere. And so we walked around and around and around. In fact, we even consulted with some policemen to find out just how legal this was. You know, we didn't want to get in trouble. And they said if you sell it at the face value of the ticket, it's not illegal. And so hearing that from a cop made me feel, you know, made me feel pretty good. It made me feel like at least I wasn't going to be spending the night in jail. Although that would probably have been more comfortable than where we did end up. And so after about 20 minutes of pacing around and getting kind of panicky, we finally found somebody who expressed an interest in the tickets. And after a bit of commotion, because the price he originally offered us was not the price he actually wanted to give us, and he didn't offer us anything really above what we paid for the what I paid for the tickets, he first offered it, and then we agreed to it, and then he sort of continued negotiating even after we had made the deal. And that's not kosher. That's not the way you do things. And we tried to explain that to him in no uncertain terms. And I guess we were about halfway successful. I may have lost maybe $2 on this deal, but got rid of the damn things. Figured the guy was probably going to resell them anyway or try to. And the only consolation I got out of the whole deal was thinking, well, maybe this guy's going to be stuck with those tickets and he won't be able to get rid of them. And he'll take the loss for being such a jerk trying to get a few extra bucks out of us at the last minute. So that was that. Had our 2 tickets, went inside, Shea Stadium, Friday night. First home game of the playoffs. Series all tied up 1-1. And wasn't exactly a perfect day for, or a perfect night for baseball. It was in the 40s. You could see the rain on the tarp. People just kind of standing around. The stands were empty. You could not see people in the stands because it was so wet. And our seats were all the way in the back of the loge. Now, ordinarily, I would complain being back there, but when you're in the loge, you're underneath the little roof, and we weren't getting wet. And everybody was back there. Even people who had seats in the front, they snuck back so that they could stay dry. It was pretty incredible. But we were in the very, very, very back row, which was also good because we could stand up. And nobody would shout at us. Of course, if we stood up, we couldn't see the field because the roof would come down in front of us. But that's just a technicality. And the night almost got a lot worse. Because it was at that moment that Jim decided to pay me for the tickets, that or the ticket that I gave him. And he said, "Here, Eric," and he gave me a $20 bill. Now, it may never be known for sure just what went wrong here. Whether I didn't reach out quickly enough to take the $20 bill, or whether Jim perhaps let go of the $20 bill 1 or 2 seconds sooner than he should have. All I know is at that particular moment in time, a gust of wind, as such I have never seen before or felt, entered our section, which was section 17, if I'm not mistaken, and carried our $20 bill away.
out of our hands, out of our clutches, away from our destiny. Now, as I said, we were in the back row. What is behind the last seat in the back row? A gate. A fence. An object that stopped the $20 bill from going any further. But within any second, that $20 bill could easily have fallen through the grating, which was pretty big, and fluttered down to the milling throngs who were still coming into the stadium. Now, I don't know if you've ever been to Queens before, but if you've ever dropped a $20 bill in the middle of a throng in Queens, and I'm not saying anything about Shea Stadium, I'm just saying in Queens. I know how Shea Stadium people get offended. If you drop a $20 bill in a throng anywhere in Queens and then walk around afterwards and ask anyone if they've seen a $20 bill, well, let's just say you won't get all the facts. And that went through our heads as we saw that $20 bill just sort of suspended there. And it wasn't suspended any longer than maybe an eighth of a second before we both lunged for it. And Jim said he was prepared to go right over that gate to get it. And I don't doubt it. We took advantage of our good fortune, carefully, slowly peeled the thing off the gate. Jim said, "Here, Eric." I said, "Thank you, Jim. Let's sit down. Let's calm down. Let's not think about this anymore," because we had already been through a lot trying to get rid of those tickets, and now we had almost had a $20 bill taken right out from under us. Let's just sit down and watch baseball as it should be played.
Yeah, you know, I remember that as if it were yesterday, but that was from October of 1988. Jim Ross and I heading to Shea Stadium to see a playoff game, first playoff game with the Mets of that year. And in fact, it didn't work out because what happened later was that game was rained out. We stayed for about an hour and a half, and eventually they called the game. And they told us we had to come back the next day at noon. Can you believe that? We were there at night, and they just rescheduled it for the next day at noon, apparently for TV scheduling purposes. So we had to come back then. And the funny thing is, when I came back the next day, I didn't even see Jim at all. Jim already had his ticket, but he had already managed to get all the way up to the front by the time I got there. So I didn't see him for the entire day. So that's the kind of guy he was. He was a survivor, somebody who always made it up to the front of an event and got what he wanted. And we're all going to miss him here at WUSB, Jim Ross, who passed away last week. Host of the, I guess, legendary Bluegrass Show. We still have Bluegrass on Wednesday nights, but Jim is the one who started it all. And in fact, I tracked down a promo for that program, which also played in the 80s, this promo did. And let's take a listen to the voice of Jim Ross, Jim Ross promo for Back Porch Bluegrass.
This is Jim Ross, host of the Bluegrass Show here at WUSB, inviting you to step out on the back porch with me each Wednesday night at 6:30. We'll listen to some of the best. Hey, we'll listen to some of the best bluegrass music anywhere. Hey, sit down. Along with some old-time fiddle bands, some western swing, bluegrass. Get out of here. Hey, sit down. Bluegrass news. So join me and my pal. Every Wednesday night at every Wednesday at 6:30 in the PM for Back Porch Bluegrass on 90.1 FM Stony Brook.
You know, everybody in the station was playing those damn dogs. We had sound effects carts that we'd make up occasionally of people screaming or cars crashing or dogs barking, and the dog barking one just happened to be around for a few months, and it made its way onto everybody's program, and it made its way onto Jim's promo there. And because Jim's promo was played in everyone's program, you heard the dogs all the more. So it was driving everybody insane, but I think he worked it into his promo pretty well there. So it's weird, too, because Jim and I probably were about as opposite as you could imagine politically, philosophically. But yet we still were able to get on, you know, to pass each other in the hallway and be civil and friendly. And that's one of the things I learned about this place is the many different types of people that you run into. People with radically different backgrounds, radically different perspectives. And yet somehow we were all on the same team. And in fact, literally, I remember once we, was it softball we played? We played, I think, against a campus newspaper or something like that. And everybody on the radio station, Jim Ross included, was part of the team. And I think we all got injured somehow. It was incredible. For the next few weeks, people were walking around limping and casts, swearing they were never going to do this again. And you know what? I don't think we ever did. I don't think we ever did. But Jim was a very important part of the movement of the station, because Wednesday nights you knew that there'd be bluegrass on. And that he'd be the person there. And, you know, he was a forceful presence. Some would say abrasive. And that's just part of the personality, you know. You got to learn to appreciate things like that. And to learn how to get on. And I think a lot of us did. So we'll be missing Jim. Okay, we're taking phone calls here, 631-632-9872, 631-632-WUSB. Let's read a couple of letters. You can write us at otw@2600.com. That's 2600.com. Don't try spelling it out. Some people make that mistake. OTW, of course, for off the wall. That's who we are. Dear Emmanuel, thanks for taking my call last week. I just wanted to clarify. This is from the person from Toronto. I want to clarify. I'm not the anonymous Torontonian. Is that what you call yourselves up there? I don't even know how to say that. Torontonian, I guess, who wrote the letter that you read aloud. You know, that's what I wanted to know. I thought you were the same guy. I thought it was an incredible coincidence. But, okay, you were different. We have at least two people in Toronto who listen to us, which is nice. Anyway, his secrets are safe. I called at the end to talk about your involvement in RNC 2004, but I was referring to a letter I had written to the show in August 2004 about RNC, not the letter that you just read. The writer probably thought I was stealing his fire or something. Maybe it's not even worth mentioning, since I'm just cluttering a mailbox and you probably already forgot, signed Adrian. Well, Adrian, it certainly was worth mentioning, and I'm sure it was a topic for discussion amongst many people in Toronto as well as here. So I'm glad we were able to straighten all that out. Dear Emmanuel, sorry I did not include the website in the last email that you read on the recent Off the Wall. This is the one concerning 24. I don't know what I was thinking. Well, anyway, here is the URL. Thanks, Lenny, for sending it in, because it was driving us crazy. It's www.watching24.com/category/24-character-countdown. And that will tell you all sorts of point scoring rules for giving people points or subtracting points for the characters and things they do. You know, I forgot to watch 24 last night. I was sick, and I totally forgot. The whole world just sort of stopped. Everything stopped. Didn't do work. Didn't watch it. I don't know what I did. I just sat around and philosophized, which I guess is okay. If it takes getting sick to get to that stage, all right. Must get sick more often. Make a note of that. Dear Emmanuel, I was listening to your show from February 13th, my birthday, and you were talking about your issues with DVD burning. Oh, yes, the massive DVD job we were engaged in to fulfill the premiums for the WBAI fundraiser. Ooh, still going on. I work at a print shop that, among other things, burns short runs of CDs with custom labels. If you're interested in outsourcing some or all of your disc production, I'm sure my shop would be happy to upgrade our burner robot to DVD burners. Are you interested? Well, thanks very much for writing in. That came from Nate. Thanks so much for writing and offering. But, you know, this is something I think we got to do on our own. And I think we're going to do it, too. We just replaced the burner, and it's much more reliable now, and looks like the end is in sight. And we're actually going to come through and... that $11,000 in pledges, we'll be able to produce all those DVDs. Great personal cost expense, but, you know, that's what it's all about, making some sacrifices. And here's our last letter, 631-632-9872 is our phone number. Get those calls coming in, we'll go right to the phones. Dear Emmanuel, I was listening to your show on the 13th. I had a bit of info on 911 calls. As I work in the emergency services as a volunteer firefighter and medical first responder, I think I can answer your question about when ambulances are dispatched during a 911 call. Here in Nova Scotia, Canada, when you call 911, your address is automatically displayed on the 911 dispatcher's computer monitor if you're calling from a landline, and they actually dispatch out the ambulance and any other required services while still talking to the caller. This is to get the ambulance on the road quicker, and as the 911 operator gets more info, they update the responding ambulance. I don't know if it works the same way in the States. I imagine it would. I hope this answers your question. Love the program. Keep up with the good shows. Danny from Nova Scotia. Thanks so much for that info. I always was curious about that. With all the people using cell phones these days, though, you have to wonder. When you call 911, they don't know where you are. And maybe some people prefer it that way. All right, 631-632-9872. That's our telephone number. Please give us a call. Let us know what's on your mind. Good evening. You're on the radio.
I had a comment about, well, at my school we had something called lockdowns, which are kind of like, they remind me of how in the 60s people hid it under the desk when they thought there was going to be a nuclear bomb.
Yeah, duck and cover, that's what that was called. But lockdown used to be a word that was only used in prisons, and now everybody in school knows what a lockdown is.
So you know about it?
Oh, we just didn't have it when I went to school because lockdowns were for prisons. Now schools are taking that one step closer to being like prisons. Have you ever had a lockdown in your school?
Yeah, we just had one 2 weeks ago, and I talked with my economics teacher I'm really close with, and he said that he was like under the impression that, oh, we need it because there might be a terrorist or a killer that comes into our school, and it's dangerous not to have one. And I think it's just like it's a waste of class time because it takes like 10 minutes of our time. We've already had like 4 this year, but just state mandate.
You've had 4 lockdowns this year?
Yeah.
Well, okay, first of all, the last lockdown, what did it turn out to be?
Well, it was just a drill.
It's like a fire alarm now? They have lockdown drills?
Yeah, they're both required by the state.
Have you ever had a real lockdown?
No.
Okay. So they've all been drills. So, okay, during this lockdown, what are you supposed to do?
They close the doors and you go to the corner of the room and the security guard yells at the people that are in the halls and get them in bathrooms and stuff.
Bathrooms, huh? Okay, now what happens if there's a fire during the lockdown? What do you do then, huh? No one's ever thought of that.
That's probably a good strategy.
Yeah, a fire drill on top of a lockdown. Where fire drill, you have to go out. Lockdown, you have to stay in. It's the exact opposite.
Yeah, and then the code, they give you like code words like Mr. Delta is in the building.
Oh, my God.
And it's obvious code words. So.
Mr. Delta. It's do most people realize what a joke this is?
Yeah.
It's unbelievable.
We had a debate in front of the whole class, my teacher and I, because we're really close. And then most of the class is behind him. That they said, "Well, what if a robber comes in?"
Uh huh. Okay.
So I guess most people do support it, which is kind of disappointing.
Well, they support it because they don't know anything else. You know, if you're brought up to believe that this kind of thing is normal, then obviously you're going to support whatever is normal. Just like back in the 50s and 60s, the duck and cover thing seemed like it was normal. Now we can look back on it and realize what idiots people were back then. But we're not yet at the stage where we realize what idiots we are now.
I wonder what we'll have, like, in 20 years.
Hopefully a lot more enlightened people looking back on this. Hopefully.
One quick question.
Yeah.
The thing we listened to last week about the jury call that you got, like, the automated system.
Yeah, you know, I should update people on that. But, yeah, what was your question?
Was that, like, one of those fake things that you did on off the hook a couple of weeks before?
Oh, no. This was real. I actually called to find out if I had jury duty, and I was very dismayed to find out that I was supposed to report the next morning. And what I wound up doing, I wound up later on that same postcard, there was another number you could call, and if you entered your juror number and the first 3 letters of your last name, you could ask to postpone to a particular date. And I simply said, please postpone this to June 1st or June 4th or whatever, because that would probably be more convenient than having to show up the morning of a radio program that I had to be in the city for. And if I got called back the next day, I would never get any sleep. So I've never done that before. I've never tried to postpone. So I figured I'd do it this time and see if it worked. The Touchstone system worked just great. And I guess in June I'll go through this again.
Okay, thanks.
All right, take care.
Yeah.
Good evening. You're on Off the Wall.
Wow, Emmanuel, how's it going?
Pretty good. How are you?
I'm good. I'm calling from Montreal.
Montreal, Canada.
Montreal, Canada. And actually, I grew up in Toronto, and I'm just calling to say we do indeed call ourselves Torontonians.
Torontonians. Now, what do you call yourself in Montreal?
Montrealers, I suppose.
Or Quebecois, right?
Well, if you're French-Canadian, I suppose.
Cool. So, Montreal, I was just there a few months ago, and had a lot of fun. Great place.
I missed you at the 2600 meeting. I was just wondering, Do you plan at all on coming up again, any scheduled service or something on your car?
Well, it's funny. You know, the car just today, I got the headlights replaced. Both headlights, conveniently enough, burned out at the same time. And it's a real problem trying to figure out how to replace them because you have to take off the front of the car. We're talking about the smart car here.
Yeah, and, it's a piece of plastic.
So. Yeah, and basically I had to go to a blog in Canada to get the details on how to do it and give that to my mechanic. And it was a whole big ordeal. A lot of people gathered around figuring out how to do it, but it got done. So I didn't have to go up to Canada for that. But the next time my maintenance light goes on, I will be driving back up there again. And, yeah, I'll try to make another 2600 meeting in Montreal. If you guys have any hacker activities going on up there, just give a shout and we'll send some people up.
Okay, and Off the Hook's on tomorrow, right?
Off the Hook is on tomorrow. Not next week, though, but tomorrow.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right.
Well, keep up the good work, and sorry for your loss, the bluegrass man.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Take care.
Talk to you later.
And that's just about going to do it for us here tonight, because we're pretty much out of time. It's amazing how quickly these hours go. But I want to thank everybody for sending in letters. Again, please continue to send your mail in because it's always great to hear from people all around the world. And we really do. We really hear from people all around the world. Back then, that piece I played before from 1988, you know, I never would have guessed at the time. That was the first year of Brain Damage. Never would have guessed that there would be a day where people would actually be listening to that program in the future and also listening to us live all around the world. I mean, you know, I was involved in computers and the internet and hacking and things like that. And you sort of dreamed about what could be, but you never actually thought it would really happen. And it's pretty amazing. It's pretty amazing. We live in a day and age now where you can pretty much call any way you want for nothing, which is what we were always trying to do back then. A place where you can digitize and save things, share music, share video. And it's positive. It's a good thing. It's really positive development, and I hope it continues along that way. So that said, let's close out tonight, going back to remembering Jim Ross. I didn't have much in the way of bluegrass. Wasn't really ever a big bluegrass person, but I did find something that I think Jim would have appreciated. He did branch out a bit. Didn't just play your top 40 bluegrass, if there even is such a thing. This is actually a bunch of Pink Floyd songs that are covered by bluegrass artists. And I think if Jim were around today, he would certainly appreciate that. I'll leave you to guess which song this is. We'll see you next week. Good night.
Hi, this is Albert Collins. When I'm out in Stony Brook, I'll be listening to WUSB FM station. When I want to listen to some good blues, that's the station you tune into.